Thank you very much. The next panel we have is Global Gun Control. The initial title of this panel when I got the agenda was called Down But Not Out, and I looked at that and I said, oh my God, you have to be kidding. I said, no, 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 it's called Global Gun Control, Up, Up and Away, because that is what has happened. So we're going to have Sheldon Clare is going to come and speak about what they've done in Canada, because the big rollback's down there. Sylvia is going to speak about some of the things that they've been able to accomplish in terms of manufacturers in Italy. And I will speak very shortly about the months and months I feel like I've spent at the UN. And Alan Youngman will follow up, and he will also be taking Mark Westrom's spot because Mark had a family emergency. Thank you.
Thank you, Julianne. Thank you, Second Amendment Foundation, Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. And thank you to the great state of Texas. I'm really glad to be here today. I want to give you a quick progress report about what's been going on in Canada. But I want to tell you a couple things you might not know about Canada. For one thing, I can mail order guns in Canada, and you can't do that down in any of your states since 1968. Another thing, I can buy former U.S. military firearms in Canada and order them from overseas. But Al was able to do that. I can buy an M1 Garand for $350 in Canada. That's kind of fun, isn't it? Canada's not so bad after all, is it? Another fun thing you probably didn't know about Canada is our government hasn't signed the arms trade treaty. Now, you have a government down here that for some reason has. I'm a little confused by that, especially with the vigorous fight I saw at the United Nations from your American delegation. You should all be proud of the fight they put on. They did a really good job for you. And people like the World Forum on the Future of the Shooting Sports, well represented by your American gun organizations, also put up a good fight representing you there. Unfortunately, your legislators down here don't seem to be paying much attention to that. But you know what? You can make them pay attention. You have that power. We know that in Canada because we have that power too. Because our government up there is getting more and more friendly with us as they recognize that Canada's National Firearms Association is actually a significant firearms civil rights lobby that they have to listen to. And we've been working hard to build a lobby in Canada. We've had unofficial lobbies for years. But we're now officially a firearms lobby. We have a new vice president here, the fellow with the camera, who's our executive vice president. He's in Drummondville, Quebec, where there's ground zero in Canada for gun control. We have a fair bit of trouble with people who don't like what we like from Montreal and places like that. And Sean Bevins there is leading our charge in representing our organization in Ottawa has our official lobbyist. So that's a big step for us to be running with a paid lobbyist to help move our agenda forward. Our Canadian government has adopted a pretty cautious approach, but we've got pretty strong indications from them that they're not going to sign the arms trade treaty. And that's going to be very, very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Now, we really need you, senators and your elected representatives, and make sure that they don't ratify what your president's trying to get passed and signed. So please help us with that, because this arms trade treaty is a bad thing. And despite what the antis are saying, it will affect your domestic firearms rights. It will affect the prices of imports. It will affect the prices and value of ammunition, and much more than that. They have all sorts of clauses in there that can be built upon to build registration systems and to adopt model firearms laws that you and we do not want. So be vigilant. Be vigilant. It's important. Now, we've had some problems in Canada, despite ending the registration of long guns, because, frankly, half the people that had firearms in the country didn't bother, and it doesn't work, and it was expensive, and it was stupid. Our government has adopted an incrementalist approach to roll back things, but we really need them to work a little faster. And in High River, Alberta, you may have heard of the big flooding that we had in the summer. Really terrible stuff. You know, usually you expect the law enforcement agencies, police, military, to come in and help people, and they did a lot of that. They got people helped and sorted lots of problems out. Unfortunately, someone, and we're still trying to figure out exactly who, got them to go around and kick in doors and look for guns and take them out of people's homes. They took something like 7,500 pounds of ammunition and destroyed it. They seized firearms from hundreds of homes, and they kicked in some 2,000 doors, even of houses that hadn't been damaged by flooding, after cordoning off the area and securing it. And as one of the officers was quoted by a person who was there who talked to him and said, you know, why did you kick in our doors? And the officer said to this woman, a friend of theirs, there's nothing quite like the thrill of kicking in a door. Can you imagine? That's outrageous. It's outrageous and it's unacceptable. And Canada's National Firearms Association is leading the way in trying to make sure that this garbage never happens again in our free country. The future for us is one of seeking more changes to our domestic laws and making sure that the garbage that's been going on at the United Nations doesn't translate into more crap for us, and frankly, for you. We want more change to our Federal Firearms Act. Unlike the United States, our laws are central. It's all centralized control. I think I heard the buzzer go off. Julianne's going to give me the hook in a minute. But I'm almost done, so she won't do it. We need to decriminalize firearms possession in Canada. It's a crime in Canada to possess a firearm, unless you have the federal license. That's been the law since 1997, from the Liberal Firearms Act of 95. We want to make sure that we review and destroy our firearms classification system, which arbitrarily says that this is a bad gun and this is a good gun. There's no such thing as a bad gun. It's just bad behavior. We also want to decriminalize our safe storage laws, which are really just anti-self-defense laws, as we all know. And we want to stop the police from being the administrators of what they enforce. That's really not their role, and that was a bad decision made by the government we have now to put the fox in charge of the chicken house, so to speak. Anyway, I wish you all the best, and keep vigilant, stay strong. I really love coming to these gun rights policy conferences and getting my batteries recharged, and knowing that there's so many fireballs in this room that feel the same way and are prepared to stand up for rights. Thank you. I also want to say thank you so much to Julianne and Alan for being models for us to follow in Canada. Because I've looked at what goes on here, and we're trying to replicate this kind of thing up north, because it works.
Good morning. I'm Silvia Gentile, attorney at law and vice president of an Italian association who protects gun rights. I'm here to tell you about the recent news on gun rights battles in Europe. In the European Union, the gun rights debate is not nearly as a hot topic as here in the US. And this is because gun ownership is not a fundamental right of the citizen provided by the Constitution, except in Switzerland and Austria. But anyway, we were seeing a continuous attempt to ban military rifles and high-capacity magazines. So why, on one hand, this spares the European citizens the debate that you have here, on the other hand, the European Union Gun Rights Association are still in the infancy phase. But what must be underlined is that many of these attacks on the UN gun ownership rights seems strangely similar to those you see here in the US. Just in these days, for example, the Italian Ministry of Interior tried to pass a legislation containing a vicious attack on high-capacity magazine and military look-alike rifles like AR-15, despite that the fact there is no history of a criminal use of these kind of accessories or firearms in Italy and the rest of Europe. But what is worse is that in the new legislation has been pushed by policy officials, which during public hearings showed to have no real knowledge of what high-capacity magazine or military look-alike rifles are, using instead the U.S. definition of assault rifles, despite the fact that by the Italian and the U.N. legislation, if they were real assault firearms, they would have been banned since forever. In any case, we cannot ignore that self-defense is a human right, and we have to fight for this right. And we have everyone will be able to defend them in his own country, everyone in own country. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Sylvia. She and her husband do incredible work over the husband there over in Europe, all over, and they will be celebrating their anniversary next week, and they celebrated their wedding by attending the GRPC in St. Louis, Missouri. So I'm going to just speak for just a moment, because I've spent the last 6 or 7 years at the United Nations in various and sundry meetings. It was a very hard summer for me because there was no meeting in July in New York City where it was 1,000 degrees, and I feel like you know, we were all lonely. We've all, Alan and some other people, and we got so used to seeing each other. it's been a very sad, lonely summer. I started writing a book, and the book was to be finished, and it would be here at the September 2012 GRPC. Because the ATT conference was going to be over in July, so you know it's pretty well written, so we can finish this off. Well, surprise, that wasn't the last conference. So then we had the second final ATT conference in April, and so I thought, well, I'll get the book done for this conference. So then we did get an ATT, much to our surprise. On Friday we didn't, and on Tuesday we did. So that was interesting. But there has been so much that has gone on now, and there are so many changes. I mean, things are shaking out, and Alan is going to speak to some of these things and some of the things that the ATT is encompassing. It's not just the ATT now. It's they've included the program of action. They've included ISACs, and these are things that really have not been discussed, that are very important, because these are going to be more regulatory. There's going to be a bureaucracy that is going to be built from this. And interestingly, in terms of ISACs particularly, this is all going to take place over in Geneva.
Thanks, Julianne. I'm Alan Youngman. I'm the Executive Director of the Defense Small Arms Advisory Council, and that's a trade association made up of most of the U.S.-based firearms manufacturers who serve the military market. However, we're all also in the commercial market, so we have a dual interest. One quick housekeeping note before I get started. Sheldon, here's my card. You can put me down for three of the $250 or $350 M1s.
Can't ship them down there, sir.
We'll work on transportation later. Some form of COD, of course.
We're happy to accept your citizenship, General.
And thank you, Sylvia, so much. You said something very, very important that I want to make sure nobody loses. Self-defense is a human right. Everybody believe that? Our country may be the only one on earth that actually believes that and carries that into practice. And that's what's kind of at the core of the problems we have dealing with other countries on these issues. And it really was hanging over the entire UN-ATT process. And we'll talk about that just in a minute. Anyway, Sylvia, thank you for reminding us. We take that for granted, I think. It doesn't exist in the rest of the world. I'm going to talk mostly about the ATT. I'm going to do so from the perspective of somebody who was there for every session involving it over the last 6 years. That's two working groups, seven first committees, four preparatory committees, normally 2 weeks long, two negotiating conferences, including the one last summer that lasted a full month, the whole month of July. And then the one in March. That's a lot of time sitting in the UN. Julianne and I both, and Alan found out recently that one more week in New York last year we would have qualified for residency. So. Secretary of State John Kerry signed the ATT on behalf of the United States last week. That was kind of a foregone conclusion. Given the number of other things going on that the U.S. is interested in and the at the UN last week, it's really not very surprising. They tried to keep it fairly low key. The president was asked to sign it by some of the NGOs who pushed for the ATT. He declined. He wanted to de-emphasize it, I think. I'm going to talk fairly bluntly. Is there anybody who's not gotten an email from somebody trying to raise money off the ATT so far? I see no hands. Okay. If I did, I figure you did not have an email account. The U.S. at this point is unlikely to ratify the treaty. It takes 67 senators, as we all remember from high school civics, to ratify a treaty. 53 senators in the last couple of weeks have signed a letter saying, we're not going to do that. So unless you can flip about 20 senators, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, it's not likely to happen. Whether or not the president even sends it over to the Senate for ratification is an open question at this point. I think Harry Reid would do. Everybody remember the Pepe Le Pew? Remember the cat and Pepe Le Pew when you would try to hug it? That's the way Harry Reid feels right now about, don't send this thing over here. We've got enough on our plate. Plus, the impact on what other gun control initiatives the administration would like to push forward would be, I think, negative in their perspective. So I don't see it coming over right now, but it will someday. And we'll talk about that in just a minute also. What is the ATT? On its surface, first of all, it's described by the lady who wrote it, Rachel Stoll from the Monterey Institute, now the Stimson Center, is creatively ambiguous. In some ways, it's kind of like the antithesis of the Bible, where you can find something in the Bible to justify anything you want to do or don't do, or the U.S. tax code, or something like that. this is the antithesis. It's very, very short for a treaty. There's nothing in it really defined. It kind of leaves it up to each individual country to define what they want to do. The intent was to get the rest of the world to adopt and enforce regulations for the import, export, and certain other activities relating to military weapons. That was the intent. Right off the bat, we already know that most of the world's major arms producers, those who produce all of the problem guns around the world, are not going to sign it. You know, the Russians announced that yesterday. We're not going to sign this thing. China, at some point in the conference, basically said, you all do what you want to do, but don't bother to try and translate it into Chinese. So, the intent, you know, the every time we go to one of these affairs, and Sheldon was there, and Julianne was there, from the third world places, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, where there are serious, serious violence problems. You know, they try to say, we need an arms trade treaty. That will take care of those things. It'll make those bad things go away. It's not. Some of the first people in line to sign this treaty have been countries that are the ones who are the worst violators. They will immediately take a shipment of Kalashnikovs from China or North Korea and sell them across the border to a political ally or just for money. They'll continue to do that. We participated in a forum at the Heritage Foundation a few weeks ago, and were asked, well, what's going to be the impact of this treaty? And I had to think back to my childhood. I don't know if they still do or not. The Miss America pageant. Remember that obligatory thing right at the end when the finalists are asked questions? What's your dream? And they all have to say, world peace. You know, that's about the level of impact we can expect out of the ATT on the problem it was intended to solve. So. It's a great, great thought, but it's kind of a feel-good from the actual perspective of solving the problem. What is the treaty not? And here's where I'm going to, you may have drawn other conclusions, you may have gotten contrary information from other people. I'll be happy to meet you out in the hall. I've got the text of the treaty, and you think I've overlooked something, you pointed out to me. It is not a direct assault on the Second Amendment in its present text, underline present. We'll talk about that in a minute also. It's not there yet. As Sheldon said, the U.S. delegation did a superb job of keeping a lot of the really bad stuff out. I mean, some of the earlier drafts, it's exactly what it sounded like. You know, it was a gun control treaty, no question about it. It's not quite that now. That's thanks to our delegation. Also, organizations like the Second Amendment Foundation, the NRA, and others who stood up and stood behind our delegation, we had their backs, and that was really important. You can't just abandon the battlefield to people on the other side. You may have heard of this national control list phraseology, and that means gun registration. Frankly, it's not there. The national control list says each country will decide on its own what kinds of firearms and other weapon systems it wants to control the export and import of. That's what it says. What will it mean down the road? Go back to it's creatively ambiguous. It could mean other things to other administrations. And as Sheldon said, it can have a lot to do with the price you pay for importing firearms. Secretary Kerry said that when he signed, the treaty recognizes the freedom of both individuals and states to obtain, possess, and use arms for legitimate purposes. That's just not true. It's not in there. It would be nice if it was. We wouldn't have nearly as much to talk about if it was. That's not in the treaty. And why he said that, I don't know. I do know that what we sought was a clear exclusion from the text of the treaty, from the scope, say, this treaty does not apply to firearms that are legally owned in countries where that's permitted. We said just very simply, take them out of the treaty. It's not supposed to be about them anyway. The U.S. delegation, I think, made a good faith effort. They were unable to make that happen. So that's not in there. Something else you need to remember, all of these organizations that are for the treaty, they're saying, well, anybody who thinks it has anything to do with legitimate firearms ownership is wrong, and they're just trying to raise money. Guess what? They're the same ones that put pressure on these third world governments to make sure that that clear language did not make it into the treaty. Let me talk about Isaacs just for a minute. First of all, Mark Westrom has been he's president of the DSAC. Until recently, he was CEO of and owner of Armalite. He's now a senior consultant to them. He's been involved in the ISACS process for about 5 years. ISACS is the International Small Arms Control Standards. It's a project from the Control Arms Office out of the Geneva headquarters in our UN headquarters in Geneva. There's supposed to be about 30 modules addressing various subjects. The way this came about, this is not a democratic process. Certain countries, one of whom has since withdrawn his funding, that said, we want to fund this effort. And they hired various contractors to write different chapters. Guess what? It was every anti-gun agenda dream come true for a lot of these folks. There's one module that has not been released publicly yet. It's on civilian firearms ownership. Why is that important? Because we're already hearing as various nations start drawing up their regulations to implement the ATT, they're being told you need to look at ISACS, particularly on civilian ownership. That could be a real problem. Down the road, the good things that are the bad things that the U.S. delegation was able to keep out of the treaty are going to come right back in. The amendment process is a simple 3/4 majority. So everything that we didn't want in the treaty, it'll be back in the day that the amendment process begins. Now, that's not supposed to be for 6 years. And that's after they have 50 countries ratify. Nigeria has this week said, well, we think 6 years is a really long time. So what's the First Amendment going to be? Change the amendment process, right? It's kind of, you're a kid, you're given 3 wishes. What's your first wish? More wishes. Even we can figure that out. So all of these things that we wanted to keep out, the U.S. was delegation was successful. All bets are off once the process starts. And the U.S. is probably not going to be a party to the treaty, so we will not be able to influence that anyway. It's going to come to the Senate someday. How can we lose this fight? Lose your credibility with the Senate. I'm talking about not just on an organizational basis, but your individual basis, the relationship you have with your two senators. And here's where I got to be very, very blunt. There's some people out there saying things about the treaty that are not true. They're so easily disproven. I mean, it goes back about, and these are people who never had anything to do with the process. We were all sitting there on the floor of the UN about 3 years ago, having just watched the U.S. senior negotiator, whom we honored at GRPC last year, fall on his sword to keep an anti-firearms ownership piece out of the negotiations, sat down, had been successful, and we all got an email at the same time from this organization saying, Hillary just signed the arms trade treaty. Well, it hadn't been written yet. Please send me $250 so I can continue the good fight. Folks, if that becomes the face of those who are trying to educate the United States Senate on this issue, we could lose at some point, because guess what? They just tune you out. There's their junior intern, some senator's office, now becomes in charge of taking care of your correspondence, your emails. Hit the delete file. We cannot afford to give up our credibility, so we've got to get the facts right. You want to know what the treaty says? Go on the UN's website and find it. Read it for yourself. We have to fight what other people are saying with the truth. The last thing I would say to you is this is going to be a generational challenge. The other side has deep pockets and all the time in the world. A lot of gray hair in this room. No. If you look at these gangs of young, poorly paid volunteers for the other side, they're like 20s. Enormous energy, plenty of money. I mean, it's going to be a long-term fight for all of us. Hear me well. Every Senate election, every primary for a Senate election, for the rest of your life and your children's life, somebody with credibility has to stand up and say, if you are elected or re-elected to the United States Senate, how will you vote on the Arms Trade Treaty's ratification? And it could be a Grover Norquist pledge type thing on taxes, but we need to make sure that every senator knows that the folks back home who are well informed on this issue are going to be watching. Thanks.
I just want to add a couple of things. The people who are on the other side, Rachel Stoll and all the rest of them, they are young. They are very, very, very young. They can go for 12, 20 hours. They can get on a flight here and there, and they are motivated. And they have volunteers like you can't believe. They know how to tweet. They know how to Facebook. They know how to do all of it. And they're doing a really, really, really good job of it. I want to thank Sylvia for mentioning the self-defense is a human right, because that is something that I know how to say. I can say that in 30 seconds at the UN, because sometimes that's all the time that they give our side. Well, they'll give us, 4 minutes for 12 of us or something? It's not a level playing field. And then I think the one thing that Alan was referring to, and he was more roundabout than I will be, is we had spent weeks and gone to all of this meetings, and we were running around like crazy. We were all exhausted, and we received an email that said, I am sitting here in New York City and I have a copy of the treaty in front of me that Hillary is signed. Okay, this person may have been in a hotel room in New York City, That's entirely possible. But they had never, ever set foot within the building. God's striking me dead. They had never set foot in the building. They had never participated in the discussions and the negotiations. And there are a lot of misconceptions. And the last thing that we need to do is to go into our senators and say, well, we heard that they're going to let the Blue Berets come in and take all our guns. Because we do. We will lose all of our credibility. But we do need to pay attention to this because they have rolled into the ATT, the Program of Action, which is small. Arms, and they have rolled in ISACs, and ISACs seems to be operating just without any controls over it at all, and it's in Geneva, which is not easy for us to go to, and they're pretty closed about it. So I would like to thank my fellow international hard workers, travelers. It's worse than walking into the New York Assembly or into the Massachusetts Legislature. It's a pretty hostile place. But again, I would want everybody to really thank you to the U.S. delegation. The U.S. delegation was really very, very good. They kept a lot of really bad things out of it for us. Yes, and the Canadian delegation, but you guys were on the wrong side until you got a government change.
Yeah, that's right. We got that sorted out.
Yes, you did.
You can do that, too.
Thank you very much.
Just out of curiosity, if we did ratify that thing, is there any chance that we could prosecute Eric Holder and throw his ass in jail where he belongs?
Okay, well, that's a topic for the...